Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. My name is Alice Thwaite. This is the show where we ask key thinkers what they value and what guides their decisions. The hope is that we can update what our morals and values should be in 2017 from an academic perspective, so that then we can make relevant decisions based on the way that society is today. With me today is genuinely one of my heroes, Dr. Sue Black. I first saw Sue speak at a Women in Technology conference a couple of years ago, where she was inspiration in getting more women to have technological careers. And with that, her own story is remarkable. Age 25 and a single parent to three children, Dr. Black decided to go back to university and gain a degree in computing and a PhD in software engineering. She is perhaps most famous for creating one of the first social media campaigns to save Bletchley Park. She's now a UK government advisor, thought leader, honorary professor of computer science at UCL. She's a social entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker. Notably, at the moment, she's teaching mums technology skills so they can continue their education or go into entrepreneurship or employment through her social enterprise, hashtag Tech Mums. Welcome, Dr. Sue Black.
Thanks very much. Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, let's start off by talking about what drives you, because there's clearly a lot that has motivated you to do what you've done in your remarkable career. What would you say are your key motivators?
Well, I guess it's a bit cheesy, but making the world a better place, I suppose. I guess a lot of what I've done in my life has been informed by what's partly about my personality, but also kind of what's happened to me earlier on in my life. You were talking a bit there about my career and stuff, but I think my life kind of changed dramatically when my go back to the beginning, when my mum died when I was 12, and my dad remarried, and me and my brother and sister didn't have a great time after my dad remarried. And so I spent 3 years kind of being emotionally bullied, I suppose, and occasionally there was some physical violence. And I just had an awful time, and I spent a lot of time sitting in my bedroom, just thinking about the situation that I was in, and it kind of, I guess, made me start thinking, well, what's going on in the world? Why is the world the way it is? I didn't have hardly any money, so I couldn't buy any books. So I spent a lot of time going to the library and trying to find stuff to read. And I think I was just quite depressed, really, for several years. And as soon as I was 16, I left home and lived with my friend's family. And kind of since then, I feel like I'm living a charmed life. You know, that's such a long time ago now. But it was, you know, having an awful experience where you're kind of restricted in so many ways and people treating you badly for several years at a young age, I think that really kind of shaped my character in a way and made me aware of the fact that the world is a very unequal place. And though, you know, we kind of like to think that everyone gets an equal chance in life, but they absolutely don't. I mean, you know, it's just there's just such a dramatic difference in the, you know, even from being a baby and growing up in different environments. There's just such a dramatic difference in life experience for people all around the world. And I think I really kind of had a strong sense of, I guess it's kind of disadvantage and what that can do to your life and your brain and your self-confidence and your outlook on life, your understanding of what opportunities there are out there, and kind of not having anyone around to support and guide you. And I kind of had a moment when I was about 15 when I just thought, actually, in the whole world of like billions of people, no one would really care if I died. And as a teenager, that's such an awful thing to have to kind of come to terms with. And so I think that dramatically has changed probably the course of my life. You know, it probably would have been very different if my mum hadn't died and kind of all those things hadn't happened. So I forgot what the original question was now, but I think, you know, I really have a strong sense that that we can make the world a better place by empowering people. So by empowering people to get out there, I love it when people come up to me now and say that I've inspired them to go on and do something in their lives and kind of take up kind of the challenges and feel confident enough to just go out there and do what they want to do, to not feel restricted by anything really. And I think, you know, we're all kind of in our own little mental boxes, I suppose. And I really, you know, I mean, I still have things that I'm scared to do. I guess I just try and push myself to get out there and do things that I'm scared of. And I have done that for quite a long time. And so I just try and encourage other people to do the same thing. Yeah, so sorry, I forgot what your question was.
No, well, it's a terrible personal story, but the question was all about your key motivators. And I suppose what you touched on was two things. So one was a sense of loneliness, which I don't know if that's me kind of putting words in your mouth there. So
yeah, absolutely. I was desperately lonely. Yeah.
But also this kind of lack of finance, like you didn't have any money also to kind of get out of the situation that you were in. So you didn't have the people that could help, nor the, I suppose, for want of a better word, infrastructure that could help. And then in terms, since you experienced that, and then age 16, you kind of got out and you perhaps found people and infrastructure that could help you. Since then, you've just been wanting to push yourself and challenge yourself to do things that scare you. But I'm curious, because I suppose, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who feel very lonely and feel trapped as well. What do you think it is that then kind of, was it a person, what was it that you learnt that meant that you could turn this horrible experience into something that meant that you wanted to go out and be scared, be afraid and challenge yourself, despite having felt that before? Is there a difference between those two notions of being scared?
Yeah, well, I think it was a really gradual thing. I don't think, it's not like I left and then I've done loads of scary things and everything worked out. It's not like that at all. You know, because that's like 40 years ago now. And I guess that I kind of just gradually become more and more confident. So I really desperately lacked confidence. So straight away when I left home, I felt a lot happier, just like ridiculously happy for quite a long time, and just thought, well, you know, I've survived that. I can survive anything. But then I kind of ended up in a marriage which ended up becoming violent, and living in a refuge. And I kind of think, you know, the things after you again, they affect the choices that you make. And, you know, I've definitely haven't made all the right choices, but I kind of got something inside me that when I've made a choice, I just get on with it. I just think I try to not really look backwards at all. I mean, fine to look back and think about things a bit, but not to regret anything, because I just feel like every time I've made a decision, even if it turned out to be not possibly the right one in the end, I kind of let myself off the hook a bit, in that I know that I made the best decision that I could with the knowledge that I had at the time that I made it. So I feel like there's no point in looking back and regretting stuff. Learn from it, sure, but don't regret it, because that's just kind of lots of negative energy, I guess. I think that I've kind of gradually challenged myself more and more, I think, and as time's gone on, I've just got more and more confident from the things that I've done, really. So, you know, so for example, you know, kind of leaving my ex-husband, I thought I couldn't do that. I had a 3-year-old and 1-year-old twins. And when we went into the refuge, and I just thought I couldn't manage on my own. But amazingly, looking back now, I did manage. And of course, it wasn't easy, but I did it. And then, you know, when we managed to get a council flat to live in, and we could move out of the refuge, and I got them into like playgroup and school, I just thought to myself, so what's next? You know, how am I going to provide a good life for my kids, the life that I want for them? And I realised that if I tried to go out and get a job, I would have been, I'd left school at 16, I would have been on minimum wage, so I wouldn't have earned enough even for childcare. So I knew that I had to do something a bit different to create a better life for my kids. So I kind of thought to myself, well, what are my options? And the only one really I could think of was to go into education, try and get a degree, and then hopefully I'd be able to earn enough money to support us all. So basically that's what I did. I did a maths course, because maths was my best subject at school. I did a maths course at the local college, and then did a degree at South Bank Uni. And that, you know, that was all extremely scary for me. I was going back into education after 10 years out of it by then. So it was 26, I think, when I started the course at college. And, you know, I remember walking into the first class at Southwark College, the maths class, and it was an evening class. And so I walked in, and there was I, like, you know, I just remember what I was wearing. I like had a miniskirt on and DMs and a like motorbike jacket, and I had like a big, my hair was dyed black and a sort of big afro. So I walked into this classroom, and it was nearly all guys in suits, and I just wanted to run away because I was so scared. But I kind of went in and sat next to a woman who became a good friend, Lorna, who was sitting at the back of the class. And, you know, we were both basically shitting ourselves, thinking, how on earth are we going to do this course when most of the other people on the course are like guys in suits and probably working in the city, you know, and here we are kind of like 20-something women who definitely are not wearing suits. And but at the end of that year, you know, me and Lorna came joint top of the class. And, you know, so I guess there's kind of just like one thing after another is like gradually built up my confidence. And, you know, like the more that you do things that scare you, the easier it becomes, I suppose. And, you know, I mean, I've just gradually continued in that vein, doing more and more things that scare me. You know, the PhD, when my project supervisor during my last year of my degree said to me, are you interested in doing a PhD? I said, I'd love to do a PhD. But what I didn't tell him was I had no idea what a PhD was at all. I just sat there hoping that he wouldn't realise. I had no clue what he was saying at all. And then, like, left the meeting, went to the library and looked it up. And I thought, oh, yeah, I do want to do a PhD. But, you know, so I've had quite a lot of moments in my life where I haven't really had a clue what I was doing and just kind of blagged my way through it, I guess. And the older I've got, the easier that's become. Well, that makes it sound like I'm blagging everything, but I just mean in terms of not understanding. It's like you don't have to perfectly understand everything that you're going to do, but you're kind of brought up thinking that everything's just got to be exactly right all the time, otherwise you're a complete failure. And I think that's very sort of pernicious.
So
it's not a healthy way to grow up with those sort of expectations.
So I suppose there were two things that really struck me when you were talking about your key motivators. I think that one of them was kind of almost a love for yourself, and then the other one was a love for your children and your immediate family. And those two things kind of, you know, struck me as being, and then you had to figure out a practical way that you could help those two people yourself and your family. Yeah. Would you say that those two might be your ultimate motivators, your ultimate drivers?
I think it is love. Yeah, I never really thought about loving myself before. I mean, when I do now, like being 50 something, but when I was younger, yeah, I didn't really realise that I loved myself, but I guess I did, right? You know, and I think, you know, that probably goes back to the way that you're brought up, and you know, the love that you get as a kid helps you to love yourself, and so if you don't have that, then it can make you destructive. I haven't really thought about it like that before.
If you didn't think about it, then maybe, I don't want to put words in your mouth or anything like that. It's just when you talked about building up your self-confidence.
I think it's probably true. I think underneath it all, even though I was extremely insecure and kind of underconfident, I guess because I did actually love myself, even though I might not have realised it. I think that's good, and that's kind of something I've not thought about before, but I think that's true. Yeah, so I think, yeah, so kind of love for myself, love for my kids, but but also now kind of love for humanity. I mean, you know, I just feel like I've met so many people that have had such awful, shitty things happen to them that have managed to kind of get their way out of it and create a great life for themselves and people around them. And sometimes, you know, like whole groups of people. And I just think that there's massive opportunities for us all to create a better existence for everybody. And, you know, I just see, and kind of like going on to technology, I just see technology as an amazing force for good in that area, in that it can connect us all up together. You know, like you mentioned the campaign I ran to save Bletchley Park. You know, without technology, without Twitter, we just couldn't have done that. And, you know, people had tried before to save it and had got a certain way. But, you know, and I just think because they didn't have those tools available to them at the time, they just couldn't have connected everyone up together in the way that we managed using Twitter. And I really see technology as, yeah, an amazing tool which we can now use to save the planet in so many different ways. You know, I think even just by connecting up experts that can solve, that know how to solve problems, connect them with each other rather than lots of people working in isolation, even just that on its own, I think is incredible. And, you know, I really feel like kind of part of my role in life is to help people to find out about ways that they can make their own lives better and the people around them, but then also all of us, you know, like the whole population of the world.
So in a way, you're, you know, the way that you see technology relates a lot to your, what we spoke about before about loneliness and money. So it's kind of bringing people together and also giving people the infrastructure to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. So to empower individuals, but also to empower groups of people, in fact, to empower all of us.
Let's talk a little bit more about this, because I think that at the moment, all I seem to read in the news about technology are kind of doomsayers. You know, the Echo Chamber Club is also built on the principle that social media has kind of pushed us into these filter bubbles. And so it's good to speak about the benefits of technology. What do you see is, you know, how can we start shaping technology to really be beneficial for humanity? Where do you see technology helping us in the future and kind of a positive outlook for the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think that, I suppose, you know, kind of what drives me now is to really help people who haven't got access to technology or haven't got access to the benefits that it can bring, to help them realise its potential for them. So the social enterprise and charity that I set up, Tech Mums, is all about empowering particularly disadvantaged mums to be able to change their own lives and then change their families' lives and their communities' lives. And with the aim of kind of starting at a grassroots level, to be able to change the way that people see themselves and see their opportunities. So, you know, like, so I've now had like 20 years as an academic, and, you know, like my technology peer group or my technology bubble, people in my kind of that I know through tech. So we all think tech's a great thing. Obviously, it's got disadvantages in the way that it's used sometimes, but see, it's a great thing that we can change the world with for the better. But speaking to people outside of that kind of technology bubble, you know, most people a few years ago anyway, I mean, I don't actually know whether people think technology is only negative now. But anyway, a few years ago, just practically everyone I spoke to outside of my technology friends thought that technology was a bad thing and would talk about, you know, spending loads of money in big government IT systems that had failed and you know, like kids having advertising parties on Facebook and people's houses getting trashed and stuff like that. And of course, you know, now we've got all the stuff with social media being used in a negative way. And so I just kind of thought to myself, technology is amazing. It offers all these opportunities. And yet in the press, in the media, it's nearly always showed as a very negative thing. And I want to really try hard to do something about that. So I started thinking, well, what can I do to try and change the way that people see technology? And I thought of, you know, I don't know if you know the Little Britain sketch, Computer Says No, but I kind of thought of that and thought, well, what I want to do is to help people to realise that Computer Says Yes. You know, it offers everyone these amazing opportunities. So how do I let them know? And I started a few years ago kind of like blogging about that and saying that I wanted everyone to learn tech skills to help them see what was out there. And I didn't quite know what I was doing. So I started running workshops for kids anyway, and ran like coding workshops, because we didn't have coding in the curriculum then, coding workshops and app design workshops with an organisation called Apps for Good, and with seven-year-old kids. And I wanted to kind of show that kids could do that stuff, because at the time Michael Gove was saying that computing is too difficult for anyone under 14. So I just thought, well, that's absolute bollocks. So I kind of wanted to show him that that wasn't true. And at the same time, I wanted to kind of test out, like, kind of sort of basic tech skills with kids. So we ran workshops for kids, and we got the parents in at the end of the day and asked them to kind of join in what their kids were doing. And I noticed that not everyone, but in general, the dads would kind of step in and just get on with it. And the mums all looked a bit scared and kind of stepped back a bit and didn't really want, they wanted the kids to do it, but didn't really want to do it themselves. And again, that wasn't everybody, but I just kind of noticed a bit of a pattern. So that started me thinking, well, if I really want everyone to be empowered around the technology, why don't I start focusing on mums and help mums to understand tech? And then that will affect the mums, but it'll also affect the kids and get the kids excited about technology and provide a kind of home environment which is supportive around the technology for children. And then hopefully the mums will go out there and talk to each other, and kind of then the communities will get excited about technology. And then hopefully gradually we can kind of get society to be more positive about technology and at least realise what amazing opportunities there are for everyone to empower themselves using tech. So that's why I set up Tech Mums, which is what it's called now. And the whole aim with that is to build mums' confidence and build their tech skills and show them what opportunities are out there. And, so that's been running for several years now. And we've had some great results. And I think that focusing on the mums, it just ticks so many boxes for me, because it empowers those mums, and particularly disadvantaged mums we've been focusing on so far. It empowers them, it empowers their kids, hopefully empowers the community. But also, like with people, kids making choices on what they want to do at university, the main influences on kids' choice of subject area is the parents. So if we can get more mums, dads, parents interested in technology, is a good thing. We'll get more kids studying tech at uni, or going into jobs in tech. And also, I set up the UK's first online network for women in tech, called BCS Women, nearly 20 years ago now, trying to connect together the women that were out there working in tech, because we weren't really meeting each other in person because there were so few. And so I'm a big sort of champion and supporter of women in tech. And so if we can create mums as tech role models as well, then, I'm kind of ticking that box myself, and that we're creating more female role models in technology too. So kind of Tech Mums ticked all those boxes for me. And I guess I think I must like kind of trying to make grassroots change happen. I guess the Bletchley thing was kind of the same, really. It was going out to trying to find everybody that was interested and get them to work together to raise awareness of the Bletchley Park and make sure that it wasn't closed.
I guess the main takeaway I've got from what you've said is that when we think about doomsayers when it relates to technology, we tend to think about these big faceless corporations, like you mentioned, IT structure, IT government contracts, Facebook, Google. Whereas actually technology also exists amongst individuals, and the way that individuals can actually use technology to improve their lives. And we tend to focus on the faceless corporations rather than, how has it benefited us? Also perhaps because negative media sells, right? unfortunately. Yeah,
and also I think loads of people working in the media, I mean, it's getting better, not that tech savvy, right? So they don't understand a lot of the technology, so they're not going to write about it. They'll write about corporations or whatever, which, is stuff that they do know about.
Politics, yeah. because I've got my eye on the time, unfortunately, I'm going to wrap up by asking the question I ask everyone, which is around what can our subscribers read, listen to, or, you know, interact with, which is going to challenge the way that they see their everyday lives? Because, you know, how have you challenged yourself? What was something that's changed your mind recently? What have you read?
I can't really think of anything specific. I think things that have kind of disturbed me recently have been actually just women's stories of how they've been treated so badly by either society or, you know, actually through social media or whatever. I mean, like the whole way that Diane Abbott was treated in the run-up to the election, and just I think we're all becoming more aware of the fact that women have been treated badly, well, women and minorities have been treated badly for such a long time, and it's all been kind of individuals which weren't connected and didn't have a voice up till now. And so, you know, all the information coming out, like, for example, the BBC pay gap between men and women, I mean, that probably exists almost everywhere and always has done. And, you know, so many people have been treated so badly for such a long time. And, like, the stories coming out, like the woman who worked at Uber, her story coming out, there are loads of cases of that happening, that sort of discrimination happening all over the world all the time, and we're only just now really finding out about it all. So I think if I can't think of one thing that I would recommend anyone read, but I think that just paying attention to those stories and realizing that this is the tip of the iceberg, and that this is gradually going to change society and the way that we do things, and diversity is going to become more and more important, and that in itself is going to make the world a better place, I think.
No, it's a very, very interesting answer. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Sue. I've found it, really illuminating chatting with you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Sue Black for sharing her story with me and you today. It may sound cliche to say that love is a major motivator in our lives, but I've really been thinking about how infrequently that's used as a genuine reason to get out and make decisions, whether at work or in your community. Perhaps it's used a bit more in religious circles, but it's definitely been something that I've been thinking about since the interview. Otherwise, I'm trying to gather data about how the Echo Chamber Club, whether that's the podcast or the newsletters, about how it's helping out our subscribers. So I'm being asked questions about, after reading newsletters, the impact that it has on the decision-making of subscribers. So whether or not that's you speak to someone differently, you say something in a different context, you react to an unfamiliar idea in a slightly different way, or even larger inverted comments decisions, like whether or not you've chosen to kind of continue or discontinue a project, anything like this. I'm just trying to find out whether or not we are having an impact. For full disclosure, I'm trying to get funding for the Echo Chamber Club, and it's good to have evidence that what the ECC does is worthwhile. So please do share your stories with me. My email is editor@echochamber.club, so that you can help us succeed and help us continue doing what we're doing. Do hit subscribe on iTunes or whatever podcast provider you use. We will be continuing our interviews after the summer. Thanks.